This is DYH, the Damn You Holyfield Network.
This podcast contains mature themes and situations. Listener discretion is advised.
This is Phil Rossi, author of the podcast novel Crescent and Notes from the Vault. You can find me at www.crescentstation.net. You are listening to episode 39 of Murder at Avedon Hill by P.G. Holyfield.
Welcome to the podcast presentation of Murder at Avedon Hill, the Chronicles of Aramis Cragan, written and produced by P.G. Holyfield. Hey everybody, and welcome to episode 39 of Murder at Avedon Hill. Thank you for your patience. This month has been a busy one for me on the home front. I'm going back to work. If anyone listening to this lives in the Charlotte, North Carolina area and has use of a trainer, a software testing manager, or a systems analyst, I'm your guy. I've also been dealing with a particularly devious computer virus, and please hold off on the PC versus Apple jokes. Everyone knows that the only reason Apple computers don't have as many issues with viruses is that hackers don't feel the need to concentrate on a machine that makes up less than 10% of the market share. In any case, the computer is working fine now, and here is episode 39. Because it's been a while, we're going to have a story so far from Nathan Lowell. Before that, though, a couple of things. First, stay tuned after the chapter for more info on the contest that ended last month, the Murder at Avedon Hill video promo I'd love for you to share with the world, and more on Flinchy and the Mexican Show Truck. Second, as always, I want to thank this week's guests. We had Michael Spence at the top of the episode with his network ID, I guess you'd call it. Recently, Michael wrote a great and extremely flattering article about Murder at Avedon Hill. I'll have the link to Michael's website in the show notes for those interested. Next, thanks to the incomparable Phil Rossi of Crescent and Notes from the Vault for his intro bumper. Crescent was one of the first podcast novels that actually gave me the creeps while listening to it. If you haven't already, please give Crescent a try. And of course, we have our guest voices. Actually, I'm going to hold off on thanking the guest voices until after the chapter, as I don't want to spoil what you're about to hear.
So that's, you know, coming along.
Well, I did want to rectify an omission I made at the beginning of last episode. I forgot to list Indiana Jim's return as Richard Avedon. He did a wonderful job for Lewis's final scene, really one of the most pivotal moments of the novel. Anyways, it's time to figure out what happens to our heroes as they continue their search for Father Joris. Thanks so much for coming back to Murder at Avedon Hill, and see you in a few.
Hi, this is Nathan Lowell, creator of The Golden Age of the Solar Clipper. You can find my books as free audio downloads on patiobooks.com and on the iTunes Music Store. But you didn't come here to listen to me. This is the story so far. Aramis Cragan and Aaron Pertee have endured much during their visit to Avedon Hill, and while they feel they're close to confronting the person responsible for the murders of Greta and Gloria Platt, they both feel like they're at the mercy of the river, its raging currents driving them towards a rapidly approaching cliff. In episode 38, Lane Nichols returned to Avedon Hill to retrieve some of her most prized possessions from the library. Surprised by Head Constable Lewis, he himself eager to slay the vampire he now knows has something to do with Edvard Avedon's condition, Lane defends herself and kills the Head Constable, Shane Olivet, and gravely injures the stablemaster, Lon Garrett. Constables Tanner and Ulrich join Aramis and Aaron, and they approach the library, only to find the building being torched by Jilly Hemming. Jilly, a Wilder, dealing with newfound powers linked to the element of fire, blamed Lane for the deaths of Greta and Shane, and responds by attempting to kill the vampire within the one place it loves most. Aramis knocks Jilly unconscious and then confronts Lane. Knowing he cannot save Lane, nor the majority of the library's treasures, Aramis escapes the fiery death trap just before the library explodes. Aaron can only stand and watch as the library meets the same fate he witnessed during his first true dreamwalk. At the end of episode 38, Aramis Cragan has reached the end of his patience and his willingness to be controlled by events. He knows the explosions that destroyed the library and the blasts that followed were not a natural occurrence, even with the magic employed by Jilly Hemming. And Aramis knows exactly who can shed light on this new mystery. And in the process, answer a question that has been haunting Aramis for over 20 years. And now, episode 39 of Murder at Avedon Hill.
Chapter 39, The Temple of Artus. The icon of Artus, child of war. While Artus resides in heaven's arena, the dead will play. The gates are sealed, but the tears have not healed. A generation after the Turim threat turned, the last great war of man will be revealed. Third Collected Prophecies of Iberian, Book 4.
How does it work, Marissa? Sulfur? Phosphorite? Nalix?
Aramis stood in Marissa's workshop, voice raised to a level just below shouting. Aramis and Aaron faced an exhausted woman. Marissa currently stood on the opposite side of her work table, as if she could use it to keep the two men at bay. She looked as if the explosions of the library had awakened her. That, combined with Aramis's tone, had caused the woman's expression to change from fatigued to frightened in the short time since they had arrived. Even so, Marissa didn't immediately answer Aramis. She seemed to be going over her words in her mind, as if this were a question she had practiced answering all of her life. Aramis did not wait for Marissa to formulate her thoughts. He immediately probed Marissa's mind, attempting to bypass any walls she might have erected against him. Due to the speed and strength that Aramis employed to force his way into Marissa's thoughts, there was no hiding what he was doing. Marissa gasped and began beating her fist against her head.
Stop that!
Aramis relented, the initial probe showing him that Marissa had a solid grasp on how to raise mental barriers against someone with powers such as his. The monk also knew he could tear them down, but only at a great cost to both himself and Marissa, and he couldn't afford to damage the doctor's mind. Aramis turned his attention to the shelves directly behind Marissa. He extended his arm, so his hand pointed over Marissa's shoulder. Aramis usually only employed an arm motion if he was trying to pinpoint the target of his limited telekinetic powers. But in this case, he wanted Marissa to understand exactly what was happening. The bottles on the top shelf of the case began to shake. Marissa followed the line from Aramis's hand and gasped as she realized what Aramis was doing.
No, 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 no!
She turned towards the wall and raised her hands, reaching in an attempt to save her supplies. But Aramis had chosen the top shelf for that exact reason. Aramis focused his energies, causing the largest bottle on the shelf to shake violently. It spun for a moment, hung on the edge like a salmon fighting the current at the top of a waterfall, and then fell off the shelf. Marissa moved forward and caught the bottle as it fell. Other bottles continued to shake. One in particular must have held some sort of active ingredient. The cork stopper popped off as the bottle tipped from side to side. Brown foam began pouring out of the top of the container. Marissa yelled behind her, tears welling up in her eyes.
It's a fulminate! Please, stop!
The last two words were barely audible. Aramis lowered his hand and the bottles stopped moving. One of the smaller containers fell onto its side but did not roll off the shelf.
A fulminate. A salt gathered from acids under certain conditions.
Aramis suddenly wished he had made more time to study the art of alchemy. He also wished one of the books he had saved from the fire had been Lapin's Codex. Marissa pulled out two small vials and a glass tube.
Mixed with mercury and placed in one of these tubes, and then set within the core of a glow rock.
What triggers the explosions?
The amalgamation is pretty unstable as it is. It could detonate if the glow rock is thrown or even dropped, but most of the time the explosion is detonated with a burn wire. It is the surest method of controlling the timing of the explosion.
Aaron, standing at the bottom of the landing just below Marissa's work area, spoke for the first time since he and Aramis had entered the shop.
But what does the glow rock have to do with it?
Marissa jumped in surprise at the sound of his voice, but regained her composure quickly.
The glow rock adds fuel to the fire, so to speak. The explosion breaks the ore into a great number of shards with little to no loss of energy, and the blast itself transforms even the smallest slivers of rock into missiles that tend to fracture even further upon impact.
Aramis interrupted.
And the explosions that just destroyed the library, what amount of this abomination did it take to create that level of destruction?
Marissa shook her head.
I have no idea. There are several secret caves where the creches are stored.
Creches?
That's what they are called. I never see where the creches are taken after I make them.
These explosives. These are how the Avedons were able to carve their way through the Lantis Mountains in the first place.
Marissa nodded.
Galen Avedon had his own munitions, and when his mining company came upon the first glow rocks while blasting, in an attempt to find a rumored vein of silver, the resulting explosion nearly brought down the entire mountain. Through trial and error, and also after several deadly accidents, the surviving miners eventually learned the power of the glow rocks.
Who knows this?
Marissa paused, unsure if she should continue. Aramis slammed his fist on the workbench.
Who?
She blurted out.
The Avedons. Of course. The Platts. The Hemmings. Tal... That's all I know of.
Aaron asked the question that Aramis didn't want to ask. What about Lewis?
No, he would not have approved.
Aramis considered Richard's reaction when they came upon the dying Lewis.
Lewis was Lord Avedon's brother-in-law.
Was? He's dead?
Aramis nodded. Marissa answered.
Yes. Yes, he was.
The remaining pieces fall into place. Another reason why Lord Avedon did not want Lewis investigating Greta's murder. Why Lewis was so worried about the safety of the Avedon children. And why he was so compelled to go after Lane Nichols.
After a few more questions, the two men left Marissa. Aramis led them back to Lane's home, where they found Constables Tanner and Ulrich. From their expressions, Aramis knew the two men had not found Lane Nichols.
Enough of Lane. If she was not destroyed in the explosion, she has certainly left town. We must now concentrate on Father Joris.
Tanner held up a hand.
Wait a moment. You said that earlier about turning your attention to Father Joris. What makes you think Father Joris has anything to do with Greta's murder?
Aramis looked from one constable to the other.
We have evidence that links Father Joris to the murder of Gloria Platt.
A pained expression crossed the taller constable's face.
Ulrich asked, What do you mean? Tanner was there with you at Gloria's house. From what he told me, there wasn't anything there that implicated Father Joris. It was a vampire that killed Greta's mother.
Tanner interjected, remembering what they had discovered at the Platt home.
The boot print. Did you match that to Father Joris?
Aramis shook his head.
No, not yet.
Tanner thought for another moment.
The drawing of the blood on the floor.
Ulrich whipped his head around and faced his fellow constable.
Drawing? What drawing?
Aramis raised his hand.
We must move past this, gentlemen. Rest assured that Gloria Platt left us information that implicates Father Joris. In the least, we need to speak to him.
Ulrich snorted.
If he was involved, I'm sure he's left town by now. Just like the vampire.
No, I think not. I realize now that Father Joris has extensive knowledge of the labyrinth underneath Avedon Hill. Have either of you showed Joris how to traverse the tunnel system?
Both men claimed they had not, and Aramis continued.
From Kell's reactions to all things vampiric, I believe he is the one that provided Father Joris's knowledge of Avedon Hill's tunnels. Tanner, because Father Joris has disappeared, the tunnels need to be searched once more. Please gather the men that searched the tunnels this morning and go through them again. If you run into Father Joris, only tell him I have information on the vampire that killed Greta Platt. That should get him to the surface.
Aramis gave Tanner a few more instructions and sent him on his way. Ulrich now stood beside Aaron, his anger seemingly abated.
I apologize for snapping at you, Sir Aramis. I just cannot believe that Father Joris murdered either of the Platts. So, what are your orders?
The monk focused on Aaron.
Have you determined our next destination, my young student?
Aaron blinked and opened his mouth. It was clear he was thinking through all they had learned over the last psych. After a few moments, his eyes widened. Aaron raised his arm and pointed over Aramis's right shoulder. There.
Towards the long-abandoned Temple of Artus, half-hidden by nearly 30 years of unimpeded plant growth, yet still managing to loom above them in the distance.
As with the rest of Avedon Hill, the approach to the temple from the southeast was marked by a slope that increased as the three men advanced upon the western edge of town. Once they came within shouting distance of the temple, the path leading to the temple became obscured to the point of uselessness. Years of neglect made it abundantly clear that if Father Joris was using the temple, he was not entering it through its former grand entrance. Once the trail forced them to walk in single file, Aramis slowed his pace, allowing Constable Ulrich to lead the way. Aramis was tired. 10 steps later, Aramis realized how ravenous he had suddenly become. But then something happened that truly unnerved the monk. Aramis stubbed his toe on a root and nearly fell. He caught himself. Aaron and Ulrich never noticed the misstep. But that simple event told Aramis something was amiss. He immediately began exploring his connection to the land, extending his energies all around him. The monk knew he had been through a lot over the last psych, especially his encounter with Lane Nichols inside the burning library. But Aramis's hunger and weakness that had become a constant presence in his life had never caused him to lose his balance. Even as he began to notice his breathing become heavier, a new realization hit Aramis like a slap across the face. Aramis whispered, "Stop." Both Aaron and Ulrich turned to see what Aramis wanted.
"Aaron, do you sense anything different?"
Aaron looked around, not fully understanding Aramis's question. "It's quiet, maybe too quiet." Aramis bent down and touched the cold ground.
"My connection to the land, to the river of magic, it is gone."
Ulrich unsuccessfully held back a snort.
Come on, old man. We're approaching a temple for Arj's sake.
It appeared that Ulrich placed little weight on magic. The constable tightened his grip on his sword as a confirmation that steel was all he required. Aramis focused on Aaron.
The river is how I have described the means by which the power of Aj flows through Cairn. Others portray this power as mists that hover over the ground, or as a fog. The most consistent element in any explanation of this divine power is that magic is an ever-changing entity. The river may run strong along a certain path, but the next day that same path may only hold a trickling stream. A raging current may be found here one day, he pointed to his left, but the same current may flow here the next, he pointed to his right. No geographic entity, no mountain, no forest, no city, not even the great oceans themselves affect the currents of the river of magic. Now, there are places that act as foci for the river, such as the abandoned elven city of Arantis. It is assumed that these places serve as more direct conduits to Aj and his children on their immortal plane. Ulrich had less patience than Aaron at this point, but managed to keep his voice at a low volume.
What does this have to do with us? I thought you were hell-bent on finding Father Joris.
Aramis stood. No matter the strength of the river at any particular place, it can always be sensed by those with any version of the gift, be it a cleric, a sorcerer, or a member of the Aaronic Brotherhood. Right here, right now, I cannot feel the river. Aramis walked forward, moving past the two men. Ulrich shook his head as if the monk had lost his mind. Aaron threw the constable an angry stare, and then turned to follow his mentor towards the temple entrance. Aramis knew he had to concentrate on the task at hand, but his mind kept turning back to the death of Constable Lewis.
He asked me to leave town to save both Aaron and I from harm.
As they neared the temple, Aramis was reminded of the song of Artus that Lewis had sung the day before.
The song of Artus, which has a power matched by only some of the great rituals of the various priesthoods, dedicated to the children. If only... Wait, the bells at the Temple of Aj.
Aramis considered what he would do if he found Father Joris in the temple.
That's it.
Aramis raised a finger, and all three men stopped some 30 paces short of the temple entrance. Aaron whispered,
What is it? The night Aaron was attacked at the inn, I could not touch the river, except through my medallion. Kel also saw the darkness that surrounded Gloria's attacker.
That he had lost his connection to the land made more sense now.
Joris is here. I know that now.
Aramis addressed Ulrich.
There is something I need you to do.
He looked at what he could see of the horizon and noted the position of the sun.
Go to the temple of Aj. Have Father Livingstone ring the temple bells at the bells of dusk. Tell him he has to play the song of Artus.
But Lord Avedon ordered that no bells...
Aramis raised a hand to cut Ulrich off. Whatever Joris was doing to keep Aramis from touching the river had not affected his internal clock. Aramis knew they had less than a fourth until the bells of dusk.
No time. I need you to run to the temple. Now.
The Song of Artus?
A confused look held Ulrich. If Father Joris is a disciple of Artus... Aramis ignored both men, physically turning Ulrich and pushing him back down the path.
No time, Ulrich. Do as you promised Richard and follow this order.
Ulrich sheathed his sword and began running back down the path, still shaking his head. Aaron waited until Aramis had turned back to the temple.
Are you sure about this? Ulrich looks like he can handle a sword.
The monk moved past Aaron towards the temple entrance.
If this works, we may not need our weapons.
As suspected, the main floor of the temple had been devoid of human presence for many years. Walls had crumbled in on themselves in several areas, with vines coming through the holes as if they had been solely responsible for the damage. The two men carefully navigated past both plant life and rubble, first to ensure they would not fall through weakened sections of the temple floor, secondly to keep their presence a secret from anyone else within the temple. It was dark within the main sanctum, and growing darker by the moment. Aramis knew they had to quicken their pace. Even in the gloom and with his connection to the land severed, Aramis knew exactly how much time they had until the bells would ring.
Soon, if Ulrich convinces Father Livingstone to ring out the Song of Artus.
They moved forward, staying close to the less damaged western wall, avoiding the center of the floor. Several rats scurried off in different directions as the two men invaded their home. They reached the rear of the sanctum and found a set of stairs leading down to the lower floor of the temple. Most temples had at least one sub-level for offices and private sanctuaries. Aramis felt confident the lower level of the temple connected to the tunnels underneath Avedon Hill. He motioned to Aaron to be as silent as possible as they began their descent. Aaron removed his pack from his shoulders and placed it gently on the stairs. After only a few steps on the circular staircase, Aaron realized that entering the temple from above had been a wise choice. Light flickered from multiple torches below them, just out of their direct line of sight. Sounds began to reach Aaron.
Voices?
Aramis, three steps below Aaron, flashed a hand signal and then moved forward. Aramis had not drawn his weapons, but Aaron held his longsword tightly. Aramis reached the lower level and stepped silently into the corridor before him. The prince then entered the corridor, four paces behind Aramis. Light emanated from a room at the end of the hallway. There were multiple entrances to rooms between them and the lighted room. The voice they had heard on the stairs became distinct as they continued down the hall.
A name. That is all I want. One name. I know we've been through this so many times, but I know it is in there. I can end this for you. Just tell me who it is.
Father Joris!
Aaron increased his pace, but Aramis held up a finger. Aaron stopped moving. The silence allowed for a new sound to reach Aaron's ears, a low moan. A creature in pain.
It has to be an animal. Please be an animal.
Aaron watched Aramis purse his lips. Aaron could see tears forming in the monk's eyes.
He cannot see anything if he cannot sense the river. What has he figured out?
Aramis silently unsheathed both of his sighs and crept forward. Aramis Cragen reached the opening to what at one time had been a large temple office. Time was not on their side if Ulrich succeeded in convincing Father Livingstone, but more importantly, Aramis had finally realized what Joris's game had been this entire time, and he had to take action. Still, the sight stopped Aramis in his tracks. Father Joris, clad as always in the white robes of a priest of Arjun, stood a short distance away. Joris faced a side wall, providing Aramis a profile view of the cleric. At this angle, Aramis could see the edges of the telltale armor Joris wore underneath his robes, namely the tanned and stretched hides of the kills he had made as a hunter of Artus. But the attire of Father Joris wasn't what had halted Aramis Cragen. What had stopped the ironic monk was what Father Joris was focused so intently upon.
By the children!
Aramis cringed at the volume of Aaron's voice.
Aaron didn't want to believe his eyes. Chained to the wall before Father Joris was a woman. Or at least what had at one time been a woman. There were so many cuts on the face and nearly naked body that Aaron thought there were more wounds than actual skin left. Long strips of skin hung loosely from the woman's flesh, flayed yet grotesquely still attached to the woman's body. A low, continued moan escaped the woman's mouth, but she was far from conscious. Father Joris had not heard or was ignoring Aaron's outburst.
I'm tired, Greta. So tired.
The priest held his holy symbol of Arjun, but unlike the last time Aaron had seen it, connected to a wooden walking staff, it was now attached to a rod, the white ivory rod that Herjar had described earlier that day. Aaron studied the face of the woman chained to the wall. In her current state, Aaron could not determine the woman's age. Hair matted by dirt and blood made it impossible to even guess its color from this distance. Even so, there was no doubt that the woman laying painfully limp against Father Joris's shackles was Greta Platt.
Greta's alive!
Hi, this is Kim.
And this is Tim.
From the Return to Northmoor podcast, and we're listening to Murder at Avedon Hill by P.G. Holyfield.
Damn you, Holyfield.
Legend speaks of a time when unwisdom will rule the land. An age of misunderstanding with little hope or depth of insight. The legend also tells of a coming together of seers and prophets who hold in their collective answers to the great questions, hewn from classic movies. In February 2009, the collective will share their wisdom. In the month of many mouths, we will hear and learn. So come, sit at the feet of Nathan Lowell, J.C. Hutchins, Mer Lafferty, T. Morris, Philippa Ballantyne, Michael Spence, P.G. Holyfield, and Scott Sigler. To be enwisdomed, please come to moviemantras.com and start your voyage to a higher state.
Hey guys, thanks for sticking around. First, a word about the bumper you just heard, and also the promo you just heard. If you are a gamer and are interested in 4th edition D&D, please check out the Return to Northmoor podcast. Kim Stone and Tim White are podcasting a D&D module, focusing on the development of a module from the DM's point of view, and the podcast is wonderful for both new DMs and veteran DMs looking at 4th edition for the first time. Movie Mantras is a fun podcast from Martin Casserly. Short, sweet, and if you are a fan of movies, you will get something out of Martin's Nuggets of Divine Wisdom. But now back to our episode. First, I want to thank this week's guests. Christiana Ellis did a great job as Marissa. KJ Johnson returned once more as Constable Ulrich. MA in PA returned for her second appearance as the now identified Greta Platt. And lastly, T. Morris gave us a great hors d'oeuvre that leads us into the main course, the climactic next two episodes of the novel. Oh yeah, sorry for that cliffhanger.
You know, that damn you, Holyfield, is really close to becoming a fuck you, Holyfield. You know that, man. You know that. I mean, I'm breaking a sweat down here.
Got some more news to go through here, so let's do it.
First, I want to thank the listeners who took the time to post reviews on iTunes, rated the podcast over at podiobooks.com, and the ones that left messages on the Karen line during the contest in November and December. We're up to 77 reviews on iTunes and 57 ratings on Podiobooks. I would really like to see Murder at Avedon Hill get to 100 reviews on iTunes by the end of its run, which, by the way, is 3 more episodes. In any case, we had 3 winners in our contest. Mildred Katie won a print copy of the novel, as did a young lady that, for the time being, will remain unnamed until she responds to my email about winning. Our third winner was Adam Teese, who won a Murder at Avedon Hill t-shirt from my store on Spreadshirt.com. Thanks to everyone that participated, and we're going to have one more contest before this podcast wraps up, so stay tuned for that. I wanted to mention that Season 1 of the short podcast I did with Patrick McLean wrapped up a couple of weeks ago on TheShawnee.com. Flinchy was a lot of fun, and Season 2 is already on the drawing board, so stay tuned for that. Now, most of you should have gotten the video promo of the podcast in your podcast feed. It's 3 minutes in length, and if you can, please link to it from your websites or blogs. If you want the embedding code so the video itself will appear on your site, just let me know, and I'll send it to you. And of course, you can take the file and put it on your website, or if you are a podcaster, please consider dropping it into your podcast feed with a note to come on over and give Murder at Avedon Hill a try. Real quick, before we go, on Goodreads, which is a great social network for book readers, it has a best free audiobooks list that users can vote on. Right now, Murder at Avedon Hill is in like 15th place, which is just awesome, but it would be really cool to see it move into the top 10. You can vote for as many audiobooks as you want, and you can rank them on your list, which in turn puts points into each book's total pool. Anyway, it's just fun, of course, but it is nice to see Murder at Avedon Hill doing well on a list that is in complete control of the people who listen. Look for that link in the show notes. Last thing to mention, and this is a pretty cool number, Murder at Avedon Hill recently went over 300,000 total downloads. Now, this, of course, is spread out over 39 episodes, the T-minus episodes, and the extra content I throw in from time to time. But this doesn't include all the episodes downloaded over at podiobooks.com. Thanks once again for listening to this podcast. It means a lot to me, and we're going to deliver something pretty special over these last 3 episodes, so stick around. See you next time. Sláinte.
Patrick McLean of the Shawnee here. A remarkable thing happened to me a while back. You see, I died. I know. Doesn't seem that remarkable to you, people die all the time, but here's the thing. I didn't stay dead. Which is puzzling, because I'm not a messiah or a zombie or a shaman or anything like that. I'm just a storyteller. So the only way I can figure that I cheated death is... I just didn't have the attention span for it. But death's loss is your gain, because now that I'm alive again, so is the Shawnee. So if you find yourself lacking a good story well told, something interesting and unusual in the 5 to 7 minute range, then it's time to check out the Shawnee. That's TheShawnee.com.
You've been listening to Murder at Avedon Hill, written and produced by P.G. Holyfield. Please visit pgholyfield.com for more information on this podcast and the author. Most of the music in this podcast generously provided by Shira Common through Magnatune.com, Kevin McLeod through Incompetech.com, and David Beard through DavidBeardMusic.com. If you are enjoying the podcast, please leave a review at iTunes and on Podiobooks.com. And become part of the show by leaving a message on the Karen line at 704-315-5884. This podcast is copyright 2007-2008, P.G. Holyfield, and is released under a Creative Commons, Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works, 3.5 U.S. license.
Damn you, Holyfield.